Are you a bit thingy about going to the dentist? I don't think anyone actually likes it, do they? But imagine not having access to a dentist in your neck of the woods. The potential consequences, they're not good, are they? For tooth decay, for gum disease, for your smile. Dr. Chris Burke is a founding member and inaugural president of the Indigenous Dentists Association of Australia. He's a Gamilaroi man and he's spent time working in many Aboriginal communities. Chris, hello. Welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, Amanda.
Now, you were the first Aboriginal person to qualify as a dentist. What spurred you to want to be one in the first place, Chris?
Well, growing up in country Victoria, it was a real interest that I had in science, in wanting to do something with my hands, and of course the opportunity to help people that really drove me to choose dentistry as a career for myself. And I think it's actually been a very good choice for me. I've graduated in 1982, so I've been at this for a long time and I've done a range of different things, and it has been, I think, in reflection, a really good choice.
Well, your first job, I think, was working out of a caravan delivering dental services in parts of New South Wales and Victoria. What were those first experiences like working with Aboriginal communities?
Well, it was a really great experience for me because it was the opportunity to take the training that you'd received. And I think, as I think back on it, I was well-trained, capable of being able to operate safely on my own as a dentist with, of course, dental assistants supporting you. But it was working in those caravans, in those little communities, doing all the things that I'd been trained to do, and actually having the opportunity to interact with people and learn about different parts of the country as well. I mean, we were out in places like Menindee and far west New South Wales, Tumut, and of course close to home at Shepparton and Wagga and places like that.
I bet it involved a bit of improvisation though.
Well, not really. No? The dental van we had was reasonably well equipped, and it was able to provide 1980s standard dentistry, which was the time. Of course, when we used more portable equipment, that actually required things to be a little bit more constrained about what you could achieve. But at the end of the day, we were actually out there and getting the job done.
What are, Chris, some of the reasons why Indigenous Australians can suffer from higher rates of tooth decay and gum disease, though, than the general population?
Well, we know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, both children and adults, have 2 to 3 times the higher rates of both gum disease and decay that non-Indigenous Australians have, and also have much higher levels of treatment need. In other words, they're not getting as much treatment as they need to manage those problems. There's a profound correlation between the social determinants of health, poverty, and that and the dental diseases, tooth decay and gum disease.
Well, we joined.
So the poorer you are, the more decay you have,
yeah,
and the worse your gums are.
Well, another dentist and dental health consultant joins us now too, Dr. Sarah Mayhubers. Sarah, hello to you too.
Hi, Amanda. Thanks for having me. Actually, it's Sandra.
Oh, what did I call you? I'm so sorry.
You very sweetly call me Sarah.
Ah, Sandra. All right, I beg your pardon.
Hi, now, Sandra.
Hi, Chris.
Now, Sandra, you've spent a lot of your career since the late 1970s working in either remote Australia or overseas in places like East Timor and Nepal and Bangladesh. What prompted your first work stint in the Northern Territory back in the 70s?
This is a story I tell many times, Amanda. It was a student experience. In my final year undergraduate studies, I had the opportunity to travel to Darwin to spend 3 weeks working in the clinic there. Within the first few days, I was on a light plane heading out to a remote community, which then was called Port Keats and is now called Wadde, and with a senior dentist, and just working on the veranda of a health centre there. And it just opened my eyes to the broader practice of dentistry, to how we could push it. And I suppose I've never been one to fall into the middle of any activity. I like to push things to the edges. And it made me realise the need in these communities and how valuable a service like dentistry is, and particularly when you take it to the communities, you overcome a lot of the issues that Chris was referring to as well, plus the immersion in an extraordinary culture within our own country.
And Sandra, from your perspective, over the years, have things changed when it comes to oral health in remote Aboriginal communities? You've also worked a few times, I think, in the APY lands in South Australia over the years. What's the picture, for example, in those communities?
Yeah, you mentioned the APY lands. I actually set up that permanent program there in the 80s with another dentist, Colin Endine, who is one of the many sort of unsung heroes who have pretty much dedicated their lives to working in remote communities. And because they're so busy working about them, you don't get to hear about them. I think some of the things that have changed, I mean, some of the health conditions have improved. Unfortunately, some of the dental conditions have deteriorated along with the increase in prevalence of chronic diseases such as diabetes and nutritionally related conditions. We are seeing more people come on board to deliver services in remote communities, and that is definitely a plus. Organisations like the Royal Flying Doctor Service have really expanded their scope of services. One of the challenges we still face, though, is recruitment of personnel, because once you expand services, you increase the need for people to work in those places. And to have personnel who actually make more of a commitment rather than hey, I had a great 2-week experience and I made a difference. Well, we still need a lot more than that.
Sandra, you mentioned the deterioration in dental health. Why? What do you attribute that to? Is that linked to diet?
Diet, lifestyle. If I can give you an example, when I started work in the 80s, when Colin and I were working in the 80s in the APY lands, of course, we collect data. And at that time, people were living closer to the land, hunting, gathering, the stores. There was only one store per community, and a community could be anything from about 200 to 450 people. So that was their main source of, the non-traditional foods. It was still quite limited. And we had no people needing dentures. You know, nobody needed false teeth in that community, none of the adults at that time. And the decay rates in the children were less than the state average. And Chris has been out there to do some research as well. And then in 2000, we sort of did some more solid data collection as part of the embedded program. And suddenly we had tens, which is in a population of less than 2,000 people, we had people in the tens requiring full dentures, and the decay rates in children had increased. And, you can never say there's directly one cause and effect, but the stores had increased their supply of, I suppose, poorer foods. There were takeaway outlets, fast food outlets attached to the stores as well, so the convenience factor was coming in, selling fried, sweetened, prepared, packaged foods. And people were sort of not moving around quite as much. So that was a little bit sad to see that it takes more than just having access to dental care, as Chris, was referring to the social determinants. So that's a little bit of a short, sharp summary of what we've seen out there.
Mm. Well, Chris Burke, in your career as a dentist, you've witnessed, I think, firsthand some of the discrimination that can exist in the health sector. And I'm thinking of, for example, when you spent a couple of years working on Groote Eylandt in the Northern Territory.
Indeed. When I arrived on Groote Eylandt in the early 1990s, there was two major health clinics that I was working in as a dentist, Anuragu and Aliangoola. Aliangoola was the town set up for the manganese miners, and it was predominantly, but not exclusively, non-Aboriginal. And Anuragu was 20 kilometres away down the road, and it was primarily an Aboriginal community. And there was a health centre provided by the Northern Territory government in each location. The clinic that was provided in Aliangoola had all the kind of things that you'd expect to have in a dental clinic in the 1980s. It was modern, set up, and ready to do whatever you needed to do. The clinic in Anuragu was far more basic. It was something out of the 1940s or the 1950s. it was there primarily to take people's teeth out, and maybe if they were lucky, you might be able to make them a denture as well. It was actually really physically difficult with the equipment that was there to actually do fillings for people. And you'd have to say to people, look, if we're going to do this filling for you, you have to come up and see me in Alyingula, which is obviously difficult for people and created another barrier to treatment. And it was astonishing that here he had two clinics provided by the government in two towns which are of similar size and yet so vastly different. Now, this is probably an example of what is often called institutional racism, where different facilities are provided for different people and you get different outcomes. But beyond that, when I said, well, look, hey, we need to do something about this, the pushback I got from government was that, people only just want to have their teeth taken out. And of course, taking teeth out is probably a good thing for some people at some time, but it's not the only answer, and people need to have a range of options available to them when they come in to see a dentist with a problem.
So, yes. Well, it's a stark case of difference, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm very happy to say that by the end of my time there, that clinic had been properly set up. So I'm glad that the government did recognise.
Well, Sandra, I think you visited this area recently yourself. How are things there today?
I've actually been working with the Aboriginal Land Council since 2011. I mean, as you can probably see, Chris and I have sort of crossed paths, you know, in our combined careers, our various careers. And I need to say that I really enjoy this program because it's the Aboriginal Land Council has actually put money into improving dental services for their communities. They're using the mining royalties money to put back into social services, and they've identified dental care as a real need. And it's a story we need to get out a little bit more to give people some idea that we don't always need to be relying on government, direct government sources or, you know, direct philanthropic funding to get programs out. Unfortunately, yeah, I think history, I mean, yeah, Chris, the Anuragu Clinic, you know, they can do fillings, but they're also sort of stuck with the footprint of the health centre that they have. And the Anuragu Clinic is still pretty tight, and but the range of services, as Chris has mentioned, is broader, and the dentists will try and have a lot more emphasis on keeping people's teeth and restoring people's teeth and restoring people's dignity in that process. And it's not just seen as an extraction-only clinic. So we are trying to sort of break down some of those differential approaches to care.
Well, Chris, as we've said, when you graduated in 1982, you were Australia's first Indigenous dentist. How many are there now? Are there enough Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people following in your footsteps into dentistry and indeed other health careers?
No, there's not. We need more dentists, but also we need more oral health therapists, hygienists, dental prosthetists. One of the interesting things that's happening in the country is also the recognition that we actually have a large pool of trained Aboriginal dental assistants, people who've done a Cert 3 or Cert 4 in dental assisting. And the recognition, particularly through the PAISH program that's based out of Sydney but working out in outback New South Wales, is that a dental assistant can actually provide a anchor on which a clinic and a service can be constructed, as opposed to sort of flying people in and flying them out all the time. It can actually sort of start to sort of provide an anchor for a community and start to really sort of get some level of continuity of care, recognising that dentists and therapists and hygienists will come and go.
Well, Sandra, along the way of your career, you started an organisation with the curious name of Teeth and Toilets. Now, putting those two things together seems at first at least a bit incongruous. What's the link between the two?
Yeah, it's an organisation. It's my life. It's you know, an approach that I suppose I ended up working through in Nepal. I've been working as a dental volunteer for a number of years, and one of the villages highlighted a desperate lack of sanitation. And my husband, at that point, had many years' experience in dealing with remote area environmental health and living conditions and how they impact on health outcomes. So Paul came across and started rolling out a sanitation program in the village, again, embedded within the community and very much run, you know, through the local villages there, and local people were employed in the program under Paul's guidance. And so it and I was already running dental programs there, so we kept those two, the focus of those two programs connected as we moved into other villages, because unless people have the right, you know, access to some sort of clean running water and ability for that water to drain away and for people to store, you know, toothbrush, toothpaste and soaps, then we can't really expect them to be sort of brushing their teeth every day as we'd like to advise them. Mm. And so it sort of became teeth and toilets, which is sort of my life. And it also, from the dentist's perspective, and Chris would understand this too, you know, quite often dentistry is seen in isolation from, you know, the rest of healthcare. It is largely private practice dominated in this country. It is integrating more, and I must admit Aboriginal health services, community-controlled health services, saw that at the very beginning when they set up, that, you know, integrated access to integrated care was going to be far more effective than sort of separating out care. And so from my perspective, it gives oral health more of a context of a health, hygiene and sanitation context, rather than we're here to fix your teeth, you know, and we can roll out toothbrushing, daily toothbrushing programs in the schools in these villages, so that the kids who are, you know, getting higher rates of decay now as they're getting access again to the more processed foods. Well, then, you know, studies have shown that daily toothbrushing programs at schools with a decent fluoride toothpaste can actually have an impact on the incidence of dental decay. So that's teeth and toilets. It's teeth in more of a broader hygiene context.
Well, Chris, what more needs to happen to improve the oral health of Indigenous Australians? Does it come down to something as simple as, you know, communities having access to clean water, fluoridated water?
Well, in Australia, there's nearly 3 million people who don't actually have a fluoridated water supply. There are still communities, both in rural and remote areas, where there is no fluoridated water available for people. Now, I think given the level of disease and the impact that we know that water fluoridation has on dental decay, this should be an absolute priority for government as a first cab off the rank situation to deal with dental health in remote and rural communities. Then there's the talk that Sandra was just mentioning about nutritious foods and the capacity to access them, the quality that's available, and of course the cost, which is in some communities quite frightening if you have a look at it, the availability of oral hygiene aids, and therefore using all that dental workforce that I was talking about before, using their different capabilities to be able to reach out to people and work beyond the episodic acute turn up to a dental clinic and have something done. Working with new parents to say, well, here's a way in which you can avoid the kind of problems that you can see around you that other children are having with your child, if you can reduce or eliminate, say, for instance, sugary drinks, which is something I'm particularly interested in getting out of people's diets.
Well, look, I wish you both well in your work and commitment to this. Dr. Chris Burke is the president and spokesperson for the Indigenous Dentists Association of Australia. And Chris was a Labor member of the ACT Parliament from 2011 to 2016. And Dr. Sandra Mayhubers is a dentist and dental health consultant. She's behind the organisation Teeth and Toilets, which works to improve oral hygiene and sanitation in communities in Australia and overseas.